Online, a good review can make a hotel trendy, and a bad one can put a plumber out of a job. It's no wonder that a few businesses are trying to fake us out, and it can be tough for a human to tell a real review from one dreamed up by someone paid to write it. But Jeff Hancock says he's got a computer program that can. He's a researcher at Cornell University who studies deception, and his team came up with software to unmask fake online reviews.
It gets at the very basic idea of what these reviews are about, trust. And as long as there's not so many deceptive reviews, we can continue to use them. But once deception gets too high, it becomes an unusable system.
So to develop the software that you did, you essentially trained it on a pool of truthful reviews from online and fake reviews written for the study. And then it went head-to-head against human judges. How did the humans do?
The humans didn't do very well, and this is consistent with about 40 years of psychological research on deception detection. Our humans got, at best, up to around 60% trying to decide between the two. The computer, on the other hand, could get up to 90% accuracy.
Why are we so bad at figuring out when people are lying to us?
Because we've been lying for as long as we've been talking. And that's about 60,000 years, so we have lots of practice.
So you've brought along a couple of the hotel reviews you used in the research, the same ones, one fake and one authentic.
That's right.
Can we hear those? And let's see if we can figure it out.
My husband and I stayed at the James Chicago Hotel for our anniversary. This place is fantastic. We knew as soon as we arrived that we made the right choice. The area of the hotel is great. Since I love to shop, I couldn't ask for more. We will definitely be back to Chicago, and we will for sure be back to the James Chicago.
Okay, so let's hear the second one.
I've stayed at many hotels, traveling for both business and pleasure, and I can honestly say that the James is tops. The location is perfect, within walking distance to all the great sites and restaurants. Highly recommend to both business travelers and couples.
Oh, wow. The first one kind of bugs me because it keeps using the name of the hotel, which, you know, I don't know if most people would do that. But the second one sounds like such an ad. I mean, there was something about it that just sounds so phony.
So you're going to go with the second one as fake?
You know, I don't know. I'm going to go with the first.
All right, you're correct.
Really? You're kidding.
You did it.
Now, what was it about both of those?
Well, I'll give you one reason. There's a kind of word called a function word. That's the thes and ahs, the prepositions, the pronouns, all the little words. We as humans, we completely ignore those. We don't pay attention to them. We don't think about them when we're producing them.
Really?
And that's one of the things. Yeah, that's one of the things we found in this study is that the fake review writers overused first-person reference. And you can hear in that ad that there's – or in that review that there are quite a few references to herself in there. My family, I love shopping, it's perfect for me, I will be back.
So the second one talked generally, but he didn't mention himself.
Yeah.
That's often –
he didn't mention himself as much, but what he did do is something quite different. And one of the things that is difficult for liars to do is to produce spatial information. You heard in that review he was talking about location to shopping,
those
sort of things.
You've done a lot of research about deception on the internet. Do people lie differently online than they have historically offline to each other?
I don't think psychologically lying has changed that much. So we see that in online dating, for example, people will lie about their height and weight. Mm. And this is not new to the internet. Men and women have been lying about those sort of things for millennia. What's new, though, is in the past, I would fake my height or weight through, say, clothing. Now, online, it's much more of a tell-me world rather than a show-me world.
Jeff Hancock is an associate professor of communication at Cornell University. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. It was a pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm John Idsty. Hurricane Irene dropped down to a tropical storm as it crossed over New York this morning, but not before dumping buckets of rain and causing widespread flooding. While the storm was not as powerful as predicted, it remains strong as it moves into New England. Homeland Security Director Janet Napolitano warned residents to stay vigilant.
Even though the storm has now been downgraded, it poses no less of a threat to communities in its path. We encourage individuals to listen to their state and local authorities as we move through the response to Irene.
NPR's Joe Palca has been tracking the storm and joins us here in the studio. So, Joe, what's the latest on Irene's track?
Well, it's been staying pretty much on course all morning, and it's now passed over New York, as you said, and it's heading up into New England, and ultimately it will reach the eastern edge of Canada and the western edge of Maine probably by tomorrow morning. Well, not ultimately. It keeps going after that, too.
Mm-hmm. Most people think of wind, of course, when they think of damage from hurricanes, but wind is only part of the story, and particularly with this hurricane.
Well, yeah, there was a lot of moisture associated with this hurricane, so there was a lot of rain. Some places got 20 inches of rain, apparently, 15 inches, just a ton of rain, falling on ground that saturated. There was a lot of flash flooding. And there's also the possibility of storm surge, where that's also from the wind, where it pushes water into an inlet or into a bay and can add to natural tides that are occurring. And there were some tornado watches posted for ahead of the storm. I don't believe any of them were actually spotted.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, the rain is falling on saturated areas, so there's still the threat going into tonight and tomorrow of rivers overflowing, even when the sun comes out.
That's right. The rivers tend to lag behind the coastal areas for showing flooding. In fact, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett says that the rivers may not crest until Tuesday or Wednesday, and he reminded people that this is not just a 24-hour event.
Mm-hmm. Now, Irene has been downgraded to a tropical storm. Does the wind still pose a threat?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, the winds have been way out in front of this. And so you can see all the way as much as 300 or 350 miles ahead of the center of the storm, you can see quite a bit of wind blowing. And of course, that's still knocking down trees and toppling power lines in some cases. The other thing that happens when a storm like this gets into a city is that the wind at the surface, so at the ground floor, is actually less than the wind as you head up the building. So that if you get up to the 80th floor, let's say, in one of these high skyscrapers in New York or Boston, which is still feeling the effects of the storm fairly severely, you can have windows blown out, and you can have wind blowing 20 or 30% faster. So it's still a big problem. And then, you know, you've got the delight of blowing glass swirling around in 65-mile-an-hour winds. Can be a little dangerous.
It's not as dangerous as expected, but still dangerous.
Absolutely.
NPR's Joe Palca, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, parents. You've made it through those first years, through all those decisions, breastfeeding or bottle, mounted safety gate or removable, overpriced organic or pesticide-grown strawberries. But just when you're ready to look at your baby, now little person, and say, job done, you're faced with the most challenging problem of all, how to get him or her the best education you can. It wasn't always this way.
Well, there was a time when you could enroll your child in kindergarten and about 13 years later sit on one of those folding chairs and dab your eyes as they graduated from high school. And that's really changed.
That's education journalist Peg Tyer. Her new book is called The Good School: How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. And most parents know that quest begins even before preschool. And Peg Tyer says it's easy to get sidetracked.
All those kids look cute. All that artwork looks creative. That's not a good way to judge a preschool. One of the things you really want to do is you want to look at the relationship between teacher and student. What you want to see is teachers who have a lot of respect for kids, who seem to know their strengths and weaknesses. Those are the kind of rich relationships you want to see, because early teacher-student relationships are very, very significant to the outcomes for your child.
When you're choosing a good school for your child, one of the biggest concerns is, of course, the teachers. How do you spot a good teacher?
One of the myths that our schools are now struggling with is that all teachers are good. And in fact, the myth that they struggle with is that the first grade teacher can as easily teach fourth grade as she can sixth grade. Like, they're widgets. You can move them around and toss them into different classrooms at will. That's just not true. One of the things I would say is a teacher who is in their first year is not a wonderful sign for an effective instructor for your child. They tend to be passionate, enthusiastic, they have a lot of energy, but research tells us that they are not that effective in their first year. So the question is, what do you do? Do you demand that your child be taken out of that classroom? Well, that's going to create chaos in the school, especially if 10 parents do the same thing. But you can go to the principal and you can ask this question. Okay, I know the research says that a first-year teacher is not that effective. What are you doing to support that teacher this year just so that my child moves forward this year and is not just a guinea pig for your first-year teacher?
Some of the horror stories in the book had parents whose child was not at level, even in first or second grade. And they went into the school and said, I think there's kind of a problem here. My child really hates reading. And the schools did not respond well to that at all. What do you do in that situation?
That actually is not a sign of a neglectful parent. That actually happened to me. So I just want to say that I wish I had this research when I was raising my own oldest son. One of the things that concerns me the most, and I think it's one of the biggest warning signs, is when a child is falling behind in reading. Reading is the kingpin skill for school success. And we know that a third of children in our schools do not learn to read proficiently. So schools say, you know, don't worry, they'll catch up. Or one of my favorites, he's just a boy. Boys learn later. Or, you know what? Let's wait until he's a little farther behind, and then we can get him to the X number special service reading specialist. That is not the answer that you want. You want to talk about specific skills that they're mastering and the ones that they're not mastering so that they can get this. Another year of the same bad instruction is not going to help your child.
A lot of parents know when they're on that school tour, when they're looking for a school, to ask about class size.
Class size seems to have been the one-size-fits-all desire of parents to have small class size all the way through. And when you look at the really substantive research on class size is very significant from kindergarten to third grade. After third grade, there's less of an impact on academic outcome.
This is the back-to-school time. What are a couple warning signs that parents should look for in these next few days as they bring their children back to school?
Well, generally the first couple of days are a happy time when everyone's pretty enthusiastic about it. The real fall off will be in about 3 weeks' time when your child doesn't want to get out of bed. But seriously, what you need to look for is a very well thought out curriculum around reading, around math. You want teachers who are bringing those subjects in at all grades. You want teachers who are all engaged in best practices so that they're not learning how to be teachers to the detriment of your child. You do want a school day for your child that's the right balance of seat time and recess. That's very, very important. And school administrators know that children need to move around, but they also know they need to maximize instructional time. And they're trying to figure out what the best use of the school day is and how to fit all those things in to keep children learning and learning well.
That's Peg Tyer, author of the new book, The Good School. She joined us from our studios in New York. Peg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheating scandals have rocked a number of school districts across the country this year. That's led several states to look for better ways to detect and prevent tampering with test results. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, some say the answer to rampant cheating is constant vigilance.
What happened in Atlanta is hard to imagine. Dozens of administrators and teachers apparently conspired to change answers on standardized tests. When those tests showed big gains, school leaders took the credit. They were caught in part because Georgia investigators have been looking for signs of tampering for years.
We're actually going into our third consecutive year of using erasure analysis on all of our elementary and middle school tests.
Kathleen Mathers runs Georgia's Office of Student Achievement. She says concerns about cheating led the state to ask test designer McGraw-Hill to look extra closely at those number two pencil marks.
And so it can differentiate between an answer choice that is definitely made and intended to be the answer choice and other choices that were previously made and then erased.
Mather says that analysis cost the state about $27,000, a small fraction of its testing budget. The data established that in many schools there were just too many switches from wrong to right. Testing forensics expert John Freemer says that information alone is just the start.
The best thing to do is looking for unusual agreement among test takers.
Freemer runs Cavion Test Security, which has helped Atlanta and Washington, D.C. investigate suspicious incidents. He says if every student is getting the same answer right or the same answer wrong, then something might be going on. Investigators also look for unusual spikes in test scores. Sometimes there's a good explanation for that improvement. John Freemer says cheating is hard to detect because, despite recent scandals, it's still very rare.
1 or 2% maybe of educators don't follow the rules.
Pennsylvania is currently looking into patterns of unusual erasures or jumps in achievement. The problem is that not every state follows up on that initial erasure analysis as vigorously as Georgia did. That probe involved dozens of investigators across state government. If you're shocked that educators would actually tamper with kids' futures, some say this sort of thing might become more common.
It's likely to be more and more pressure on teachers and administrators to cheat.
Professor Gary Miron of Western Michigan University says this problem is part of the troubled legacy of No Child Left Behind. The law said the fate of entire schools would be determined by test scores. Schools that fail can be shut down, and bad test scores can also jeopardize funding. And now a growing number of states are planning to evaluate teachers based in part on test scores. Gary Miron says before No Child Left Behind, schools tested less often and more carefully.
No Child Left Behind required testing to be rolled out at each of the grades between grades 3 and 8. But with this, it meant that we had to distribute limited, resources for testing across more grades.
Miron says that leaves less money to check for tampering. But others in the field say scrutiny of test results costs only a fraction of testing budgets and should be considered part of the cost of doing business. John Freemer of Cavion Test Security has built a business on this assumption.
You're not going to be able to run a state testing program without doing comprehensive analyses of the results. I mean, that ship has already sailed.
Most states have joined in an effort to establish a common national curriculum and eventually a common set of tests. Eventually, they hope to administer most of those tests by computer. The use of computers could make it tougher to tamper with results, or it could force investigators to develop a whole new set of tools to find and stop cheating on standardized tests. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm John Idsti. This week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is expected to release its latest update on the food stamp program. It's an important indicator of the nation's economic health, and the prognosis is not good. Food stamp use is up 70% over the last 4 years, and that trend is expected to continue. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Gwax is here with details. Welcome, Marilyn.
Hi, John.
So the economy has been growing for more than 2 years now, slowly, but I guess not fast enough to slow down the increased use of the food stamp program.
Right. At this time, 4 years ago, just before the recession hit, about 27 million Americans were getting food stamps. Today, it's about 46 million. That's roughly 15% of the population. And what's really striking when you look at the chart on this is the line just goes straight up. Economists think that the report that's going to come out this week, it'll show that it keeps going up.
But the economy has been adding jobs since 2009, not enough to make a real dent in unemployment, but still an increase. Why doesn't food stamp use reflect that?
Well, there are a few reasons. First, nearly half of the 14 million people who are unemployed right now have been out of work 6 months or longer. And many of them, even when they do find jobs, remain eligible for food stamps. And that pretty much illustrates the other problem. Wages haven't been rising to keep pace with food costs. About 40% of the food stamp recipients live in a household where a family member is working. They are earning a wage. But the government's latest inflation report shows that the cost of living has gone up 3.6% over the past year, and wages really haven't budged that much.
And there are a lot of factors behind this rise in food prices.
Now, you name it. We've had spring floods, summer droughts, soaring global appetites for our foods. Those factors have contributed to about a 70% rise in the price of corn just since last August.
And can the food stamp program keep pace?
John, that's unclear because this is a very expensive program for taxpayers. It's not that it's so generous to individuals. The maximum for a family of four is $668 a month. That works out to about $42 per person per week. So if you figure each person eats three meals a day, that's about $2 for each meal. But when you put it all together, the collective tab is pretty big. Last year, it totaled something like $68 billion.
And that's certainly a lot when Congress is looking to cut federal spending.
Exactly. Spending on food stamps, you know, it was actually increased back in 2009 as part of the federal stimulus package. But that extra spending is going to expire in 2013. Of course, extending that kind of funding would be very controversial. Some economists say that the program is certainly worth every penny because it stimulates the economy. And really, there's not any question that a lot of grocery stores would see a huge drop in their business if their customers couldn't afford to buy food.
Right.
Some economists say that aid for food helps families spend more money on things like gasoline to drive a family member to work or to get coats for the kids to go to school.
But then, of course, there's the other school of thought that says government assistance leads to long-term dependency.
Yes, there are other economists and certainly a lot of lawmakers who would say that food stamps dampen your incentives to go out and find work or even do things like plant a garden. And there are also questions about fraud. Although about a third of the people who qualify for aid actually don't go and get it, there are lots of other people who try to scam the system. And, of course, plenty of taxpayers just object to this idea of having money taken from their paychecks and using it to put food on somebody else's table. These are some of the issues that I think we're going to hear a lot about in the coming month when lawmakers return to Washington and the farmers start to harvest those crops.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax, thanks for joining us, Marilyn.
Oh, you're welcome, John.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm John Idstey. The rapture, or Judgment Day, when the faithful are rescued from the apocalypse and the end times, is the starting point of author Tom Perata's new novel titled The Leftovers. It's about the lives of the people left behind, how they cope with loss, where they look for comfort, and how they move their lives forward. Perata's six previous works of fiction include Election and Little Children, which were both made into movies. Tom Perata joins us from WBUR in Boston. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So why did you choose The Rapture as a point of departure for the novel?
You know, I had been thinking a lot about evangelical Christianity in relation to my last book, The Abstinence Teacher. It was a kind of exploration of the American culture war that was going on during the administration of George W. Bush. And I started thinking a lot about the rapture and especially the idea of the tribulation, the seven-year period after the rapture, when the people who are left behind have to sort of, they get a second chance to get it right and fight on the side of good. And it struck me that the way that our culture works now, 7 years is an incredibly long time. And in my mind, I thought, you know, some people 3 years in won't even remember the rapture. They'll just be on to the next thing. This, you know, apocalyptic event will be absorbed into the narrative of history, the way that all kinds of other, you know, hugely traumatic historical events got absorbed in the flow of history.
And actually, there are a lot of rapture deniers in the novel, or people who just think it's some other kind of phenomenon. There's a whole range of descriptions for it, right?
Yeah, you know, I didn't want the book to turn into a sort of critique of the Christian rapture, and I didn't really want to get too literal. I really wanted to use the rapture as a metaphor. And the event in the book is known to some people as the rapture and to other people as the sudden departure. One of the reasons for this difference in opinion is that it's not just the Christian faithful who've disappeared. It seems to have been a sort of random act. You know, millions of people all over the globe of all sorts of religions and all sorts of non-religions have disappeared. And so it doesn't make sense within the framework of the Christian apocalypse.
As part of your research, did you read the Left Behind series, the very, very popular evangelical books that were written on this subject?
I did, of course, because I sort of knew that I was wandering into territory that Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye had explored in that wildly popular multi-volume series.
And do you see your book as a continuation of that genre in some way?
Well, I don't know. I certainly see the relationship. I have a feeling that people who approach my book from a kind of straightforward Christian position will see it much more as a subversion of that genre rather than an extension of it.
But in any case, it creates lots of interesting scenarios, people examining why they were left behind, people trying to make sense out of life, lots of introspection and reexamining of why we live our lives the way we do. Really great grist for a novel.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun for me in the course of writing this. I mean, The Apocalypse was a lot of fun for me. you know, one of the things I was able to do in this was to create some cults that seemed to me plausible expressions of sort of contemporary American culture. So there's a group called the Guilty Remnant who dress in white and chain smoke. And this chain smoking is an expression of their disbelief in the future. And they travel around just sort of shadowing people so that they will never forget what's happened. They call themselves living reminders.
One big issue, of course, is people who thought they should have been taken in the sudden departure or the rapture, like the evangelical minister, Reverend Matt Jameson of the Zion Bible Church. I wonder, actually, if you wouldn't mind reading an exchange between Reverend Jameson and another character, Nora Durst, whose husband, Doug, and children, Jeremy and Aaron, all disappeared during the sudden departure. It begins with a response to Reverend Jameson from Nora.
Okay. There was no rapture, she told him. The Reverend laughed as if he pitied her. It's right there in the Bible, Nora. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. The truth is right in front of us. Doug was an atheist, Nora reminded him. There's no rapture for atheists. It's possible he was a secret believer. Maybe God knew his heart better than he did. I don't think so. He used to brag about how there wasn't a religious bone in his body. But Aaron and Jeremy, they weren't atheists. They weren't anything. They were just little kids. All they believed in was their mommy and daddy and Santa Claus. Reverend Jameson closed his eyes. She couldn't tell if he was thinking or praying. When he opened them, he seemed just as bewildered as before. It doesn't make any sense, he said. I should have been first in line.
And of course, Reverend Jameson ultimately had a very nasty response to his situation. He starts trashing the reputations of all the people who were taken.
That's right. I think one of the things that happens in the wake of these disappearances is that a lot of people tend to romanticize the people who've left. They call them heroes and sort of assume that they were chosen because of their virtues. And this, I think, really offends the Reverend, who sees himself as a sort of more virtuous person, a more faithful person than a lot of the people who left. And to prove it, he becomes a kind of investigative journalist and goes around digging up dirt on the people who disappeared just to make it clear to everyone that this couldn't be the Christian rapture because God wouldn't have chosen these particular people.
One thing that occurred to me as I was reading is that all of us eventually disappear, and the emotions and responses of those who are left behind is, you know, very much like the responses of the characters in your book.
That's a really interesting point. I think, you know, I may have started out writing this novel thinking over theological questions and really thinking about the rapture as a sort of literal event. But I think the more I explored these characters, the more I came to the idea that the rapture is just this beautiful metaphor for growing older and living with loss and being conscious of all these very significant absences around us. And so you're right, the book is, in a sense, a kind of concentrated exploration of grief as a kind of communal fact of life.
Author Tom Perotta, his new novel is The Leftovers. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.